For the week of May 24th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 495, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Happy birthday to our longtime listener, Bob Dylan. It was his birthday yesterday. I celebrated by listening to Highway 61 Revisited. What did you do, Sperling?
I went on Highway 61. I revisited Highway 61.
Well, I drove down that.
No, I didn't do anything, actually.
You could
I was tangled up in blue because I couldn't.
He's not necessarily a listener to our show. I have listened to his radio show, the Old Time Radio Hour, whatever it was called. I assume he doesn't listen to our show, but if he does, happy birthday.
Yeah, we should do the show as Bob Dylan, you know, in the voice of Bob Dylan.
I am down for that. You threw in the Tangled Up in Blue. I can do that. I got the Tombstone Blues with all the death and dying going on around the country. I thought the New York Times front page was pretty impressive. Really,
that was unbelievable and very unexpected.
Well, it was a good idea. Of course, they filled the front page with quotes from obituaries to try and personalize and humanize the idea that 100,000 people are dying from this and the number in the United States is still growing. They filled the front page with a name of a person and some fascinating, interesting, touching detail, like one woman who died was the first Black woman to graduate from Harvard Law or something like that. Another person, you know, performed in his church choir for 30 years, you know, and his people all over the country jumped into a middle page. It was great. It was really well done. But before we get into all the news of the day, we have some cleanup to do. First, Lynn Shelton. We talked about her death a week or two ago. And I mentioned her as being part of Mumblecore. Our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, says, you know, she's about as much to do with Mumblecore as Louis Malle had to do with the New Wave. He's sort of thrown in with that group, but he's not really his style or his thing. And her movies were quite plotted, especially the one about the two guys trying to film a gay porno, the two straight guys. So that was Hump Day sort of broke her out. She had pretty well-plotted movies, so she wasn't truly part of the Mumblecore, though she's often grouped in that.
You know why I think she's grouped in that? Because
they needed a woman.
She cast a lot of the Mumblecore actors, the people who were a part of it. She would then cast them, and then thus she got lumped into. I always thought, like, when I saw her obituaries, I thought, really? She's Mumblecore? I thought she just cast those people, but I guess maybe she's a part of the Mumblecore.
Well, no, I think you nailed it on the head. That's a good reason why she's got sort of mixed in, but sad to see her passing for sure. And another thing, one of our readers called in or texted in and said, hey, that story about the PBR, about the bull riding, how they're one of the first sports in North America that's going to be including fans again. They're going to have a PBR event, a bull riding event in some state, and they're going to fill up the stands, you know, like 30% capacity, social distancing, attendants wearing gloves to open doors and things like that. They're going to do everything they can to keep people safe, but they are pushing aggressively to have fans in the stands. And this reader pointed out, hey, by the way, don't forget, PBR is owned by William Morris Endeavor, which really needs the money.
That is very, very true. And if you listen to Showbiz Sandbox, you would know why they need the money, because we talk about it. We have been talking about it quite a lot. They gain 50% of their revenue from live events.
Right. And I don't know that having fans in attendance at a particular event will go into their pocket, but it certainly increases the TV value of that. And it's just a part of getting back to normal. Maybe that's one reason they are pushing aggressively in that area. I'm sure they would say they're doing it with fan safety first and foremost. We'll have to see what happens as numbers continue to spike. I'm in Alabama and numbers continue to rise.
Well, you know, we get, 50% of our revenue from live events as well.
Do we really? Yes, we do. Yes. We get 100% of our revenue from space flight. That's where we get 100% of our revenue. It's sending people into space. That's really the core business of Showbiz Sandbox. But on the side, we do talk about the entertainment news of the week. What are we going to talk about this time, Sperling?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are enjoying the holiday weekend. It's a holiday here in the U.S. It's Memorial Day, a time for us to stay home from work, spend time with our family. Maybe cook a meal together, go for walks, you know, enjoy Zoom chats with friends. Wait a second. Dear God, it's been Memorial Day for like 2 or 3 months at this point, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, never
keep
mind.
Going, keep
we,
going.
We may have socially distanced barbecues and there's no box office to speak of, but we also have you, our loyal listeners. And for you, we'll keep things as current as possible. We'll cover the latest on how the industry is handling the pandemic around the world, including some good news from Venice. We may or may not discuss the most popular films and video on demand because, you know, it's a holiday and those rankings may be delayed. We're looking at UCOM score. On Inside Baseball, we'll look at the latest feature film to jump to streaming and discuss the proposals from the Writers Guild of America to fix residual payments and make sure those reflect our new reality when it comes to Netflix, Disney Plus, and the like, which, by the way, actually does affect everybody around the world because it would mean these services, well, what we'll explain. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the top headlines in entertainment. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's video on demand charts.
And that's the sound of crickets.
Oh, okay.
I got nothing. I got nothing. There are no video on demand charts because it is, in fact, Memorial Day. We're recording on a Monday, May 25th. So even those charts are not available to us this week, we are seeing a little more stories and reports about box office from drive-in. I think last week, maybe the total box office was actually a couple million. It may have been more than $1 million, but there are still no official charts or numbers coming there. So we don't have that stuff yet. So we are eager and excited to get back to normal as long as people can be safe. It's going to be a couple months before we get there. So right now we should move on to some good news in our coronavirus update. There is some good news here.
You know what? Before we move on, can sure. I just point out one thing?
Please.
So we're talking about video on demand, or you were, and the fact that we don't have that information, and this will actually come into play a little later during Inside Baseball. But this past weekend, I watched The Lovebirds. And if you recall, that was a Paramount movie mm-hmm. that was supposed to be released theatrically. It was teased at CinemaCon last year, and then it was supposed to be released this year. Needless to say, it wasn't released this year because it went straight to video. Straight to Netflix. And it dawned on me that this very well may be the most watched title on VOD this past weekend. Now, it's SVOD, subscription VOD, not TVOD, which is what we always talk about, because that is the only thing that we have any figures for. And by figures, I just mean a ranking of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, we don't actually know 5 million people watched X, 7 million people watched Z. We don't know any of that. And so in a way, not knowing how many people watch The Lovebird is kind of disappointing to us who track these types of things. But as we'll see, it's very disappointing to those who could benefit from it financially.
It's also bad for business. I think in the last week, Netflix tried to put out some stat claiming some such show or this or that or the other thing was really popular and X number of people watched it. We're ignoring that because their stats are BS. You know, you watch 5 seconds of a YouTube clip and that means that counts as a view. You watch, you know, even if it's sent up to you automatically and it starts to play, if you don't turn it off quickly enough, Netflix says, oh, you watched that. They've stopped saying, oh, you have to watch 70% of it or something like that. So their numbers just are not trustworthy. So we're not going to report on them. And what that means is without some reliable third-party number or numbers that they can convince us are legitimate, you know, if somebody watches 70% of a movie on Netflix, I would say, okay, that's a legitimate view. If that was their standard, I would say, well, I wish we had a third party, but hey, they say 20 million people watched a vast majority of The Lovebirds. I would take that as okay. 20 million people watched it over the first 3 days or whatever. But because they can't share that information and we don't trust the information they do share, no one's going to be saying how popular The Lovebirds is this week. Reviews came out and then boom, it's over. A season comes out, when they drop it, boom, it's over. There's nothing more to say. Every once in a while, a show will become a phenomenon like Stranger Things, will accept the fact that it's really popular and people keep watching it. But 99% of that stuff just goes into a black hole. And once, you know, they need that reporting, they need those solid numbers so people can keep talking about their product. I think they're really missing out here.
Well, the way they look at it is when they release those numbers, and I've watched the arguments that agents make. And by the way, this leads us to Inside Baseball at the end. So maybe we should pick this conversation up at the tail of our show when we are talking about it. But it is very important to agents when they are negotiating with Netflix and they're negotiating in a black hole again, more on that during Inside Baseball.
Sure. Well, we've talked about that before. They can't talk about how popular a series or movie is because they don't know. But we do have some good news. The Venice Film Festival is on in September. They're not telling us how or what new changes they're going to make, though, of course, there will be changes to the way it would have been done last year or the year before. But Venice may well be the first film festival that comes back in action this fall. What do you say, Sperling? Is that exciting?
I think that they have to say that, even if they know that, you know what, this is going to be really hard and it might not happen. We have to say that it's happening right up until the point where we know it's definitely not going to happen, because we need the submissions. We make a lot of money off of submissions, even though we'll get, you know, 2,000 submissions and we'll only accept 200 films.
Won't they have to refund submission costs?
Nope.
Even if the festival doesn't occur?
That is correct. They don't have to read.
So you think they're scamming people? You think we know their festival will not take place. People are not going to go to Venice in September to have a film festival. It's not happening. The international community is not coming. I don't know if Cate Blanchett is going to agree to be the head of the jury and wear a mask for the whole
time. Is she supposed to be the head of the jury?
Yeah, she's the head of the jury. It was announced before. So you think she wants to go to Venice and wear a mask and put herself at risk so that they can have a film festival and get their submission money? No.
Well, let me think about that for a second. I mean, if you really... No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to put your family and
your children at risk so you can be the head of a jury when it's not safe yet? Let's jump right here to it. Vanity Fair. This is part of the bad news. In Vanity Fair, they're reporting that theater producers and concert promoters know for certain that 2020 is not happening. One of the quotes from an exec is, "I am 100% positive it is not happening." End quote. There will not be Broadway. There will not be big concerts in Madison Square Garden or venues like that. It's not happening.
Do you think that Broadway will really just not reopen in 2020?
How can they? I don't see how they're doing it in South Korea and these other places. You can't make money if every other row is empty, and no one's going to want to bring their kids back. It costs the same amount to mount a show as it does if the house is full or empty. So you're still going to need to spend $800,000 a week for a musical. And if the theater is half empty to begin with, you're starting with half empty theaters, and you can't charge premium pricing for a seat in the back of the balcony. So it's not like you can charge premium pricing to everyone. Who wants to pay a premium price to be a guinea pig? Nobody. So travel, tourism, are tourists going to flock back to New York? Theater producers are thinking March. They're, as we reported before, the theater owners are ready to go. Producers of Broadway shows are thinking March of 2020 is when we may be able to start opening back up again on Broadway. Same thing with touring productions. So if theater's not happening and concerts are not, no one's going to go to Madison Square Garden for a concert in September. The idea that journalists are going to go to Venice and risk their
journalists. What about the actual attendees Venice?
Well, right. Journalists, the market, the people, the actors and people, they're going to go to Venice to sit in crowded rooms with each other. You know,
well, think about it. You know, the New York Film Festival, I follow Eugene Hernandez on Twitter I'm sure you do as well. He's the head of the New York Film Festival and the head of film at Lincoln Center. And he said a couple of weeks ago, hey, tune in tomorrow to the, you know, are you following at NYFF? Because, you know, we're going to have an announcement tomorrow. You should follow it. And I thought for sure what they were going to talk about is the fact that they were going to cancel the New York Film Festival.
Well, they wouldn't tease negative news. They wouldn't say, listen forward to some bad news coming soon.
Yeah, they didn't. It was like their selection committee or something like that.
Right.
It was the announcement. Right. And I thought, wait, you have a selection committee? You do know they will be selecting nothing.
Well, let's try to get back to some good news. In good news, Bombshell, the musical, might actually happen. That's the show based on the NBC series. And instead of being the show within a show, a musical about Marilyn Monroe, they are planning to mount Bombshell, the musical, as in the behind-the-scenes making of a musical about Marilyn Monroe. I think you were a fan of the series, Sperling. Are you excited?
I was. Smash was the name of the series.
Yes.
As you stated. And you, I believe, what's the word that you hated it?
I never watched it. Never watched a single minute of it. I did not hate it. I never watched it.
So, I didn't really pay much attention to the actual musical within a musical, because there was a musical actually in the show itself was a musical. So I never really cared about whatever they were trying to produce.
Well, you have to care that it's something worthwhile to care about. You think they're trying to put on a show and you get excited by the characters and who they are and who gets cast and the songs that they write.
Right.
If you're not engaged by that, then there's no show to watch. This is what they're going to put on stage, the making of a musical. Do you think it'll be a good property?
It could be. It could actually be, and frankly, it might be one of those properties that's better than the actual television show.
Right. So that's good news for fans of Smash. And more good news, Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5 will soon resume shooting. This week, we believe this week in New Zealand, Avatar 2 will begin filming. Resume filming is what I should say. Production was shut down, just like the Lord of the Rings spinoff that's being made for Amazon, I think. That may start soon. We haven't heard word yet. They were teasing photos of Avatar. And yes, they say this week they will begin filming again. So that's good news. You know,
so what we were watching before, or what they were teasing before, was just stuff that they had already shot.
Well, they were just showing stills of like saying, we want to get back to work. We're going to get back to work, and showing old stills of it. As we said at the time, we didn't know what it was and we didn't believe they'd started yet. The daytime Emmys, that Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5 will not be eligible for that. But the daytime Emmys are going to be airing virtually on CBS. They couldn't have handed out the Tony Awards because there wasn't enough product and nobody could see it. They should have done a virtual Tony celebration, a clip job with Neil Patrick Harris or James Corden hosting from home and people chiming in. I think it would have been worthwhile to do. Daytime Emmys, they got enough product to talk about. They've got like 3 soap operas left. You know, if you don't get nominated for best soap opera, you're really angry because you're like, they left you off. There's 4 shows and 3 of them get nominated. You got to feel really bad.
And you know, I think that I really like your idea about the virtual Tony Awards.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, here are all these networks who have no
reruns.
Yeah.
The CBS Sunday movie looks like, you know, it's the logo from the 70s, which I like. I'm an old person, so that appeals to me. But, you know, they're showing reruns of Titanic. You know, come on. You could do a clip job of the Tonys, and there's no reason not to. It's the 75th anniversary of the Tonys. So do that in the fall at least.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, have a bunch of, you know, James Corden, as you said, Neil Patrick Harris, maybe Cheetah Rivera, you know, cut to them in between.
Reminiscing about their favorite show or their memory or whatever. Yeah, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, what else are you going to show? Something, as you said, from the 70s?
Mm-hmm. And speaking of award shows, the Producers Guild of America, no shock here, will consider streaming films for its top award. Obviously, for this year only, there will be restrictions. It will all fall by the wayside next year. We can now assume that any other award show you want to think of is adjusting to the new normal, at least for this season. So we're done reporting on that because that's just the way of the world. That's how it's going to happen.
No, the next thing we have to report on is whether it will actually change permanently, whether it will change the mindset permanently of awards voters.
No.
Okay.
Right. I don't think the Oscars are going to suddenly say, you know, we don't care where you air. They're trying to promote the film business as its heart, which is an exhibition and theatrical exhibition. That's the heart that drives everything. And I don't think they're going to suddenly say, "Hey, we can accept streaming."
You know, I did wonder.
The rules always get tweaked, I guess. But you know.
And I was about to go into the whole like Lovebirds of it all, but I know we're talking about that later. So I'll save it until later.
Well, Lovebirds will be eligible for Oscar stuff this year because they did plan a theatrical run. It's clear as long as they don't submit it for Emmy consideration, then it is eligible for Oscar consideration, which it won't get. You know, it got polite reviews. I like Issa Rae. She's fun. But when based on the reviews of the movie, it was a big whoop. Nobody really, it was fine. It was okay. That was about the best review it got.
Wow. That's your way of getting us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
It is the way I get us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Here we were trying to make the show shorter and we're actually repeating our own intros.
We are repeating our own intros.
Unbelievable. Okay, well, look, our first story. Last week, we focused on the U.S. theater industry and the unique challenges it faces. Invariably, the problems it faces are the same theater companies are dealing with the world over. In fact, we talked about that last week as well. So it's really no surprise to hear bad news from the United Kingdom. First, the country's national theater is planning to fire as much as 30% of its workforce. Ugh. Without the government support, the National says it may have to close get this, for good. Not just like, oh, we'll close until... No, for good. And the Telegraph newspaper said they see the same dire situation throughout the entire country. It begins its analysis with this warning. Okay, this is straight from the Telegraph. British theater is on the brink of total collapse. All the performing arts, theater, dance, opera, comedy, theater and education, Christmas pantomime, comedy shows...
Community.
Well, those two, community shows as well, are facing the real possibility of complete obliteration. I know it sounds melodramatic, it beggars belief, but it is a statement of fact.
End quote.
So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, there's no audience. Donors are broke. They're not going to be given the way they were giving a year ago. And 6 months with no income is the best case scenario. They're still hoping to open up in the fall. I don't see how it can happen. And if it does happen in any way, shape, or form, it will not be particularly profitable. If you're really, really lucky, you won't lose money by opening up in September. I think that's really the best case scenario for live theater in London, in the West End. So this is really scary. It's really dangerous. The National Theater is not going to close. I don't say that to be Pollyanna-ish or to ignore the grim reality of what they're facing, but they're not going to let that happen. The government will somehow step in. They will make sure, but it will be a lot more weakened if they lose 30% of their workforce. It's not like they had a lot of fat at the National. So
No, not at all. They were pretty lean.
Yeah, I mean, so this is scary and dangerous, and I can see this same thing happening all over the U.S. 6 months without income and then no donors to step up to the plate in the following year because they're hurting. This is really, really a big problem.
Well, I think it's the same in France. It's the same in Germany. It's the same in Japan.
Yeah.
The Guardian and the Telegraph both had stories on this over the weekend. It was a big story in the United Kingdom. And the fear is that 70% of live theater will be gone by the end of this year.
Oof. Well, you know, I saw, I was in the grocery store and I saw People magazine, and who knows on the cover? Queen Elizabeth at 94. She's still going strong is what the cover said. And that links us right into our next story, doesn't it?
That's true, because in a deal that seems about 40 years too late, People magazine is launching a TV version of itself. They will actually be turning the pages for you. The popular newsstand magazine trafficking in celebs and real life stories will become a syndicated series to compete alongside Entertainment Tonight and Extra. Remember, Meredith Corp bought a lot of Time Inc. properties, but they sold off Fortune, Sports Illustrated. You know, they even sold off Time itself, but they kept People and plan to use Meredith's 17 television stations across 12 markets as the core of a nationwide reach here in the U.S. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I was going to say a big whoop. Magazine gets TV show. And I also felt like, really, 40 years too late. By the way, good joke about them just, you know, videoing the magazine and turning the pages. But anyway, I've sort of changed my mind because I do think they are distinguishing themselves from everybody else. As they say, they really have a strong, you know, history of true life stories and, you know, heartwarming true life stories. Celebs come there to open up. It's a safe space where they know they'll be treated with dignity. They reach people in the heartland with stories of regular people facing trauma and stuff. So I do think that's how they're going to distinguish themselves from Extra and Entertainment Tonight and all the other news magazines that are really celebrity focused. People magazine is more feel good. It goes beyond that celebrity focus. It's real life people. So I think that will make them distinguished. It's still going to be really hard to do, and they should have started this 40 years ago. But, you know, they've got a little something different to sell. It's still a really valuable property, and I still don't understand why Meredith bought all those magazines and then sold off Sports Illustrated, Time, and we're like, what was the point? But what do I know?
Comic Joe Rogan's podcast is one of the most popular in the world.
Second only to us.
That's right, yeah. And in a blockbuster deal valued at $100 million, it's coming exclusively to Spotify. Since all the major music streaming services offer, you know, essentially the same digital delights when it comes to popular music, Spotify wants to set itself apart as not just a music service, but as the biggest audio platform in the world. Hey, tell that to YouTube, by the way. Spoken word now accounts for 24% of Spotify streaming, and every minute spent listening to a podcast is 1 minute less listening to music they must pay royalties on. Investors, Well, they were impressed. The company's value soared by nearly $4 billion after the deal was announced. In any case, Apple Music and Amazon and the others are going to need their own exclusive content. So, you know, I have a, you know, I got a couple of ideas. Like, let's say a podcast, maybe? What do you think? You know what? As a matter of fact, guys, Amazon, Apple, call us, email us. The number is 888-567-SAN. That's 888-567-7263. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And by the way, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal. Whether it's a good deal, I'm not so sure. A lot of people say, you know, when you shut yourself off from everyone and become an exclusive podcast on an exclusive platform, that doesn't help you. Sometimes you just wait a year, Joe Rogan, you can see how powerful you are now. Howard Stern, does he have the same visibility and reach on Sirius XM or whatever it's called now that he did when he was on terrestrial radio? I don't know. He still gets in the news sometimes, especially when he trashes Trump. But you do feel like I'd love to listen to Craig Ferguson. He's on Sirius. I've never heard a note of his radio show because I don't subscribe to Sirius. If I had some way to hear some of his show, I would do that. So he's the most popular in the world. Spotify is bringing him in. That's certainly going to help them bring in people to their platform, no doubt about it. Tim Ingham at Music Business Worldwide. I get more and more great analysis from reading him lately. He's on Rolling Stone as well as MBW. He says, look, Spotify insists it needs to pay music artists less because it's not making money. They're saying, look, this formula doesn't work. We can't keep shoveling all this money to you. We're losing money. And so he points out, well, if that's so, how can they afford to spend $600 million in the last 18 months on acquisitions and licensing in podcasts? It is a little hard to say you're going begging when you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on podcasts. But that's the hot area, isn't it? Larry King, 86 years old, he wants to take us on. He's launching a podcast in a new deal. And you know what? Spotify is not an open platform. Like the podcast platforms we're on, you just have to get on it. On Spotify, you have to apply and they decide whether you get on it. So it's not something that anybody can access and use the way that podcast platform on Apple, you know, we can get on that pretty easily. Spotify, not so easy. In fact, we've been trying and we're still not on there.
Yes.
So do you think Spotify. Do you think it's a, call us. Yeah, do you think it's a, is what's holding it up, by the way? Give people a little insight.
I don't know. I think they just have a backlog
of 10 million, of Larry King and Joe Rogan. Yeah. We got to clear them first. Mm-hmm. So do you think it's a good idea or not? Is it a good way to spend their money and bring people to Spotify? It certainly lowers the money they spend on royalties. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. Certainly, they are becoming the you know, Apple. Here's an example of where Apple fell asleep at the switch. They were, and still are, for the most part, the podcast leader. And now there are others that are kind of nipping at their heels and eating away at the fringes to the point where they're becoming the dominant players.
All right.
Speaking of dominant players, Jeffrey Archer is coming to Hollywood. Lord Archer is a wildly colorful figure in the United Kingdom, having served in Parliament and having served in jail. Actually, he did go to jail, all while churning out potboiler thrillers that have sold some 275 million copies worldwide. That's million with an M. Now, at the age of 80, Archer is getting his first representative in Hollywood, IPG's Joel Gottler. His books have already proven rich ground for adaptation, including the casino caper Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less, and the miniseries Cain and Abel, you know, among others. His newest two books featuring a brilliant Scotland Yard detective, and, you know, by the way, that's me. I'm the brilliant Scotland Yard detective. Looks set to become the basis for an ongoing series or string of TV movies. Really, I that was a throwaway joke, and I fully expected you to say that I don't have the accent for Scotland Yard detective. And no, okay, big deal or big whoop.
Let you sometimes just hang out to dry. That's what I do. This is a big whoop. It's bizarre. Whatever, 80 years old. He's like, hey, maybe I should get someone in Hollywood. I guess this particular franchise that he started is the one that may set him off. But I would have thought that would happen with the Clifton Chronicles. He wrote seven books in the Clifton Chronicles, a rich, wealthy people thing, somewhat inspired by Downton Abbey, perhaps. It was a melodrama times 100. Each book ended with a cliffhanger leading into the next, all in the like early 20s, I would say. I think the Titanic was involved. But they were catnip for readers, sold a lot, and I thought someone would turn them into a miniseries or ongoing TV show, but that hasn't happened yet. So someone's probably already snatched up this Scotland Yard detective stuff, But if you're looking for material, the Clifton Chronicles, pretty easy to turn into a fun miniseries, I would say.
I was trying to think of some joke about it's a yard, and it's an actual yard, a Scotland actual yard.
Shouldn't it be
actual...
a Scotland meter?
Yeah, that's true. Oh, that's true. Actually. Wait, no, they are on the metric. They're not on the metric system in the UK, are they?
Blimey.
Now, every 5 or 10 years, an outlet becomes the new hoped-for savior of canceled TV shows. You know, maybe PBS will pick it up. That's what everybody would say, what, 30 years ago. Maybe HBO, that was like 20 years ago. Maybe Netflix, that was like 10 years ago. Now, the streamers aren't the place of last resort. First, Netflix canceled the sitcom One Day at a Time, only to see it revived by Pop, the home of the late-lamented Schitt's Creek. Now, Netflix canceled the critical favorite Tuca and Birdie. And instead of the cartoon disappearing forever, it's been picked up by Adult Swim. So who knows? Maybe someday a show will be canceled by HBO Max and revived at NBC. Anything can happen. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big whoop, though, from what I've heard about the show. It's a good thing. I'm happy to know Tuca and Birdie will have a second season. It was very well reviewed. I think one thing hasn't changed. Things go from a bigger outlet to a smaller outlet. You know, Netflix is big enough that when Pop or a cable channel picks it up, that ain't going to a bigger platform. That's going to a smaller platform. So, you know, Tuca and Birdie going to, where did they go? They went to Adult Swim. That's a smaller platform, arguably, than Netflix. So whether it's NBC to PBS, a big network to HBO at that point, going to HBO was sort of, you know, a smaller, more elite audience, but it was not like being on NBC. So all these things happen in a similar way, bigger to smaller, but it's great to see if your favorite show gets picked up and survives for another year, you're happy.
You know, we're about to find out whether Batwoman can survive without Ruby Rose, mm-hmm. because Ruby Rose is leaving the CW series Batwoman. All sides insist it's amicable and that the demands of the hour-long drama made everyone an unhappy camper. The makers promise they'll find another queer actress to play the semi-iconic role, and everyone made nice when her departure was announced. And who knows, maybe Rose will pop up in Zack Snyder's new cut of Justice League. I mean, you know, why not?
What?
OMG, Justice League could be 4 hours long. I just read, yeah, I have got to get HBO Max before I do. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
The Snyder cut, a 4 hour cut. And he insists now that he cut it down to 2 hours and 20 minutes, but they still weren't happy. It was, you know, then tragedy struck. So yes, the Snyder cut is coming to HBO Max. They're spending $20 to $30 million to finish the special effects on all the extra footage that they have and to tidy it up and make a final cut. That may be a 4-part or 6-part miniseries presented as a TV show with cliffhangers, or maybe one long movie or a two. They don't even know what they're going to do, but it will bring people to HBO Max. And in terms of spending an extra $20 million, I don't know if it'll pay off, but it's like the Friends thing. It will get them attention. So in that
case, is very true.
That works. As far as Ruby Rose, I don't think sometimes we appreciate, you know, it's hard to talk about hard work when people are paid, you know, a lot of money to get to act. But shouldering a drama, even much more so than a sitcom, shouldering a 1 hour drama when you're in most scenes and all, that can be very challenging and hard. And I hope, you know, Ruby Rose has a great career ahead of her and gets lots of other opportunities, because not wanting to do that or not finding that something that you were ready to deal with is not the same as not being a hard worker and ready to go ahead. So I think it's cool that she said, look, it was too damn much. And, you know, I wasn't ready for it. It's a slog, and you have a huge weight of responsibility on your head when you're leading a drama and nothing happens without you. So, you know?
And it's a very physical role,
right,
as well.
Yeah. So that is a hard thing to do. And it can be. And again, everybody depends. The whole room is staring at you 24/7. You got to make everything happen. That's a tough thing to do. So I'm glad she was open and honest about why she was stepping away. Everybody seems happy. And, you know, hopefully the show will continue if fans love it. And hopefully she'll have more great work ahead of her.
Now, never waste a good crisis. And during the pandemic, more and more people are embracing UBI.
Yang, Andrew Yang. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, no, not a universal basic income, though. Oh. You know, that too is, you know, it's gaining traction. We're talking about UBI, universal basic internet. Until the federal government stepped in, 90% of Americans had no access to electricity, which was an urban phenomenon. The divide for a high-speed internet isn't that bad, but at least a third of the country has no access to broadband. You can spot the digital divide in two ways. One, look to rural communities. Internet providers will never spend the money to reach far-flung consumers in isolated areas. And two, look at poorer neighborhoods, poorer people. Even in big cities, poorer people are far less likely to be able to afford a high-speed internet connection. With the pandemic, we can see how essential high-quality internet access is to, say, education and work and civic engagement. So has UBI's time finally come? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I hope it does gain traction. Rural communities are the new inner city. That's a phrase that I heard that resonates. When you look at poverty rates, drug addiction, life expectancy, employment levels, divorce, all the things that can really cripple a life, rural communities are falling further and further behind. And one thing that can help them, just like electricity made such a huge difference, is to bring the high-speed internet to every part of the United States. And that doesn't happen without government intervention. If we waited for the private business to do it, they still wouldn't have electricity in all parts of this country, not even close. So you got to step in. And speaking of this, I think a new idea from cord cutting, which we talk about cable, is the idea of Wi-Fi cutting. My friend is in Atlanta and he has Comcast as his provider. Who's your provider, Sperling?
Spectrum. Speaking of HBO Max, mm-hmm. HBO Max, if you have HBO, say, on Spectrum, you get HBO Max, because you've already subscribed on cable.
Right.
However, the one company, one of a few, that HBO has not cut a deal with is Comcast. Now, let's talk about these conglomerate issues that we highlighted when they were occurring, when these deals were going down. Comcast owns, both NBC Universal and these ISPs, these internet service providers. They're a cable operator as well.
And Peacock, they have Peacock, the soon-to-be-launched streaming cable company thing.
Right. And meanwhile, you've got AT&T, which is a telecom company, which now owns Warner Media, which also is an internet provider, which also has Dish, basically is a cable provider. So they are direct competitors. And now if you are a Comcast HBO subscriber, if you subscribe to HBO on Comcast, you cannot get HBO Max.
Well, that's annoying. And so what's more and more people are doing, of course, they're getting rid of traditional cable because the bills got so big, which is what my friend in Atlanta did. He went down to Wi-Fi only, and then he has streaming stuff. So now he has, and he does not even have a TV bundle like YouTube or anything like that. He just has straight streaming. That's it. He doesn't watch that kind of TV. He just watches stuff on demand. So he went down to $60 a month just for Wi-Fi only from Comcast. Guess what happened this month? Boom, it went from $60 to $100. $100 in 1 month. $60 wow. to $100. He said, what? So he has no cable, just the internet. And he's like, oh, you got to be kidding me. So he was looking to make his phone a Wi-Fi hotspot. I'm like, that ain't going to work. And he tried to see, well, I could download Netflix shows at work and other shows at work and then come home and watch them. And I could use my phone as a Wi-Fi hotspot when I'm, working. I'm just like, you also got to make sure first, when they say unlimited data on your phone, make sure that, they're not going to throttle you after 5 minutes. Sprint does offer free high def streaming and like a unlimited data up to a certain level, but the speeds aren't necessarily going to be high speed. So he tried desperately to see if he could just get rid of even that, but it wasn't going to work. But he called him up and he's like, I'm switching to Sprint. I'm just going to do that, And they said, well, all right. They offered him, you have to subscribe for a year. You have to go paperless, but then you can lock in $60 a month for the next year. So that's what he's done right now. So if you got your cable bill or you've got your high-speed internet bill and it's giving you sticker shock, call them up. At the very least, you can get a year and probably a low rate or stick with the rate you already had. But I think if it's possible, people are going to look to go some other way. Maybe some smart telecom company is going to say, maybe we should provide home-wise, high-speed internet to people via the phone or some other way. Maybe we can make that work. Because any way to get around the cable company, people are going to jump at it.
Well, there are parts of Napa Valley, okay, you know, the big fancy Napa Valley where they make all the wine, that do not have high speed internet. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a place where billionaires and millionaires live and grow wine, and yet, you know, they don't have internet. So it's not just poor area. It just goes to show you that rural areas, it is expensive to string that cable, and people don't want to do, you know, the companies don't want to do it. They already have a monopoly. What's the point? They're not going to make any more money out of those subscribers. But don't get me started on internet because you know, we're doing these CJ Cinema Summits every week, and I needed to.
I haven't been a guest yet. Because you're not in cinema.
Yeah. Well,
and how are they going? You know,
they're going very, very well. They're webinars, but I needed to increase my internet speed because I was the only one that was very blocky. Like my video was blocky because they're video, not just audio. And so,
but you had the guy over, and they said technically you cannot get higher speed internet because of the way they break down the system near your neighborhood. In order to get the high speed internet to your home, they would have to split the nodes, or they would have to do something to make sure they could get more traffic coming into your home and going up because the system was not built in order for you to send video out to the world, just like your Correct. Electricity system was not sent to for you to send, you know, electricity back to the power station. You can actually do it. They were sort of surprised when they found that out. That's why people with solar panels can send power back and get some credit. But it wasn't designed to do that. And while that works, it really doesn't work for you because they never anticipated people in their homes would start creating high def, high quality video and want to stream it out to the world.
Right. Well, and so sure enough, on my block, I've seen that Spectrum cable truck like three or four times. And it's people saying, look, the download is fine. It's the upload. But the upload, like the max I can get is 44 megabit per second, which should be fine. But I can't even get that. I'm usually like at 1.5 megabit per second or 3 megabit per second. Meanwhile, the other folks on the CJ Cinema Summit, they're in the Nordic countries or in the EU.
They're fine.
They're getting a, you know, synchronous, like 300 megabit per second down. It's like unbelievable how good their internet.
What's their uploading speed?
It's synced. So it's 300 up, 300 down.
Oh, sweet. Well, that's pretty insidery baseball, isn't it?
It is. It is very insidery baseball. Did you know that Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing?
No.
That we explain what they mean for the business and more importantly, how they affect our listeners.
Sounds
Did you
great.
Know that that's. That's what we do with that segment.
No, I didn't, but it sounds great. Let's go.
Well, you know, speaking of streaming, Tom Hanks wrote and stars in the World War II movie Greyhound. This was a big film that exhibitors were really desperate to get their hands on because it stars Tom Hanks and, you know, let's face it, he's a bit of a draw. You know, it's a thriller about a convoy traveling through U-boat infested waters and trying to get safely into port. Trailers began appearing earlier this year, and the film looks to be a real winner for the Saving Private Ryan crowd, you know, smart, adult, fun, crowd-pleasing, and, you know, who knows, really. It's potentially Oscar bait. And now, instead of debuting in theaters, along with two other Tom Hanks vehicles scheduled for this year, it's coming to Apple TV. In a major grab, Apple spent $75 million to get worldwide rights to the film, which will now debut on the streaming service, presumably later this year. That sent shockwaves through the exhibition channels, you know, all those cinema operators, and it's highlighted the importance of a new proposal from the Writers Guild of America. Right now, TV shows and movies that are on streaming services fall into like a black hole as far as talent is concerned. There's no box office, there's no viewership numbers, there's no residuals, and the WGA wants to change pretty much all that. Maybe not box office, since there wouldn't be any box office, but they certainly want the viewership and residual data. So I guess really, let's dive in. I mean, first, Michael, what do you think of Greyhound kind of moving over to Apple TV?
Well, I was kind of shocked and I don't get it, but you tell me. I made up the idea that people were shocked in a sense. I said, I just wrote that. It sent shockwaves. Did it? Did it really?
Or are they not just, really?
Really?
No, I mean, at this point, it's kind of like, okay.
But why in God's name would you send this straight to streaming? It is not a small
I'll tell
film.
You why. Because
well, hold, let me make the counter argument, then you can show me why I'm wrong. It just seems like it's a good Oscar movie. It looks like a great audience draw. They're going to need content when movie going begins again. They think it's July. Well, maybe it'll be later in the year before people come back in full force. But whenever that is, they haven't been able to film all this time. There's going to be a big gap. They need good, high-quality entertainment. And there's no way, shape, or form that Greyhound will suddenly look dated or not cool or not worthwhile in 6 months or 8 months or whatever. So what's the rush? Why did they need to get it onto a service and get their money back?
Well, it was a Sony Pictures film, okay, for Father's Day weekend. And I guess I'm trying to see like who sold it, really. The project was assembled by CAA Media Finance and Film Nation with Getlow Helmer, Aaron Schneider. So really, these are people that probably needed the money.
Why?
And they knew that they, well, because they're a financier. They're basically financing it.
But then when if Sony picks it up, it wasn't a straight distribution deal, wasn't it? Then they pick it up?
I don't know.
They wanted to cash out early? They're like, it takes years for a movie to cash out. So they surely are, suddenly they're cash strapped and they said, we just need the bucks to keep the lights on?
Well, someone like, Film Nation, yes, because that's pretty much how they, you know, they're a financier and they have, you know,
but why loans to pay back. And why wouldn't Sony, I mean, the reported budget, at least on Wikipedia, I don't know what their source was $50 million, which seemed low to me for a movie set on the water and in a period thing, but maybe a lot of it is interior. I don't know. But that was the reported budget. They sold it for $75 million. If Sony wanted to buy it outright and just say, you know what, we need product in the can, we'll take this. We know it's going to be a valuable product whenever we release it. No one's going to think, oh, that old thing. Why didn't they?
Well, why didn't they just take it
and say, here's the money. Now we'll take all the risk and you got what you got.
They've also seen the movie at this point.
The movie looks great. This is not a movie that's a piece of junk. Come on. No, let's not assume that it's a turkey. This looks like this was a big summer movie. The trailers are great. It's Tom Hanks in a World War II film. Even if it didn't get great reviews, there's no reason to assume this is a turkey that they're now trying to hide. Let's just assume it's a good quality movie and that even if it's a bad movie, Tom Hanks is a good draw commercially. So let's put that aside.
Well, I also think that they're looking at who would go see this movie, and they're looking at a very adult audience, older people, and they're going, will they actually show up at the theater? We're going to have to hold this movie for a year.
Well, they need movies in a year. They need movies. I'm shocked. It just seems ridiculous to me. This is not a small movie. It looks a movie with a lot of upside, and they need product 6 months from now. Whenever people do go, they're going to be able to go back to movie theaters before they can go to Broadway in a concert. Movie theaters.
Well,
I'll tell you this:
whenever a decision like this is made, it always has something to do with money.
Well, and you make a good point.
Guarantee that a part of this has to do with loan repayments and when they needed the money and how they needed the money and I'm sure they did the math on this and went, you know what? By the time we're all done, we'd make $45, $50 million back. We wouldn't lose our shirts. Here, we got a guaranteed $70, $75 million. Let's go with it.
All right. Well, the fact is that once it goes to Apple TV, they're done. People aren't going to make a lot of residuals on that. There are formulas in contracts already. When something goes to a streaming service, whether it's Apple TV or Netflix, whether it's a TV show or movie, there will be some residual payments, but they're pretty minimal and low. They're certainly not based on how popular something is. And the WGA is saying, you know what? This is a problem because more and more movies and TV shows are going or originating on streaming services. And so per Deadline, quote, the WGA has proposed a tiered system of bonuses to increase streaming residuals in its ongoing negotiations with management's AMPTP for a new film and TV contract. A new contract is up and the WGA is saying, you know what? We need to look at the streaming residuals because that's where all the action is happening and we want more money. That's the basic way to put it. In streaming, residuals are a low fixed annual payment. Whether you wrote an episode of Stranger Things or an episode of, say, Sperling Reich's World of Wonder, an essay on digital distribution.
Hey, that actually sounds like a good show.
That does sound like a good show. So the WGA is proposing that the more popular a property becomes, whether it's a movie or miniseries or ongoing TV show or doc or what have you, the more money the writer should receive. And of course, we know that if the writers get more money than the director and producers and other people who get a piece of the pie, they're going to get more money as well. What do you think about that?
I think that good luck getting those numbers. You don't get them on DVD. You don't get them on VOD. You don't get them on Blu-ray. You've never gotten them for home entertainment, specifically because that would mean all of these agents, all of the talent would say, hey, you know what? Give me a piece of this. And they were never able to get it on home entertainment. writers, actors, directors. They were never able to get it on Home Entertainment. And guess what? This is just an extension of Home Entertainment. And this is something that has actually caused a lot of strife with the actual, even studios that actually produce shows for Netflix.
I have no idea how well it's doing.
Right. And so they will produce a show like, I don't know, 13 Reasons Why, right? And the cast will come back to them and say, hey, you know, we just read this story in Variety and The Hollywood Reporter and Deadline, and all the trades are saying that—
It's hot. It's hot. It's the big show. It's trending on Twitter.
It's a big, big show. And guess what? Stranger Things, they got this huge, you know, they're all getting like $20 million an episode, and I'm exaggerating, but they're getting a lot of money per episode. And you know, we're popular too, just like Stranger Things. So we want the same thing. So can you go get that for us? And so the lawyers at 13 Reasons Why, I believe, is Paramount. So the lawyers at Paramount will call Netflix and say, hey, you said that 13 Reasons Why is popular, and so is Stranger Things.
And you'd like another season.
You're right. And my folks over here, they want to get the same deal that Stranger Things has got. And you know what the answer from Netflix was when that happened? Well, you're not as popular as Stranger Things. That much we can tell you. You're popular, but not as popular as Stranger Things. And we're not going to tell you how popular Stranger Things was or how popular you were so that you can compare. So just go back and tell your talent, the people that you're hiring, that. To which the lawyers kind of throw their hands up in the air and go, yeah, we're screwed. We can't negotiate this way.
And so the one way that negotiates is up front, where you get more money up front. That's sort of what they're doing. But the other big jump is when you go to season four. That's very typical on streaming services. You can get three seasons at a certain rate. If we renew you for season four, you're going to get a bump. Maybe sometimes a significant bump, because that means we really got a hit on our hands. So 13 Reasons Why, they did renew it for a fourth season. It's also the fourth and final season. So they decided it was worth their while to do one more season, even though they would likely be paying more money. But however,
actually, it's after, I can tell you, it is after the fourth season that occurs.
No, it's not the third season.
No, and actually, no,
that's
I have
why so many shows get canceled after three seasons. If you look at Netflix, show after show after show can't get beyond season three. That's why Good Times, One Day at a Time closed at season three. Let's look this up, because I believe I'm pretty firm that it's season three. Where, you know, the season four
well,
is where
I think
a
maybe
new
on streaming it's season three. I do know on television it's season four, because you needed 100 episodes.
No, that's different. Yeah, no, TV, your big payday comes when you hit 100. It wasn't that anything kicked in because you were into a fourth or fifth season. It was because four seasons, you were hitting 100 episodes in the old days, because you had 22 or 25 or 30 episodes a season of a drama.
Now you don't have any
of
that.
Sitcom,
you
right?
Don't
have any. So that was a different one. But yeah, 100 episodes was magic. That meant you could strip it in syndication and make really good money. You kind of felt you needed 100 episodes. Not always. Star Trek, lots of other shows work. But 100 episodes was the magic number. So yeah, you're right about that. But now in streaming, the new level of pay, when you sign up for a show, they say, all right, here's what you're getting for 3 years. If we go 4 years, you're going to get, you know, a 30% increase or something like that. So that's I think, a pretty good rule of thumb. And I think I've confirmed that already looking at some stuff. But here's another problem with the residual layout. International residual payments. You do a show for Netflix, it doesn't just get shown in North America. It gets shown all over the world. Currently, payments for international streaming are just 35% of North American streaming payments. Guess what? They have much bigger audience overseas. Just like movies are now making more money internationally, depending on the film. But the big studio movies, they're making a half, two-thirds of their money overseas. So why would you get less money for that market? In Netflix, they have a big worldwide market. So why should your show get less when it's showing in the entire world rather than North America? So Netflix and Disney Plus are getting bigger and bigger overseas. Netflix doesn't even want to break down their U.S. subscriber numbers and tell you how many new people have signed up in the U.S. because the big action is overseas. So that's a big problem too. It doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, I mean, if you look at Lucifer as a perfect example, why do they keep making that? I'll tell you why they keep making it, because they make all of their money back. Warner Brothers makes all their money back from one territory. They have sold everything to Netflix.
Is it Germany?
Germany. Yes. They basically said, here, we'll sell it to you. We'll call that money gravy because it's pretty much all profit when we sell it to you. And we will keep Germany because that basically pays our production costs plus some.
Well, and Lucifer, by the way, they were filming a fifth and final season at one point, but then
now they've come back.
They were going to do a sixth season, but the filming of season five did have to stop right near the end of the season because of the pandemic. So they are doing a fifth season. It looks like now, even though it was renewed for a fifth and final season, now they've got a sixth season happening again, like you say, because of Germany. So that's very interesting. Here's another problem. We've talked about premium video on demand. We've talked about subscriber or subscription video on demand. That would be something like Netflix. Premium video on demand is, say, you're paying $20 to rent a movie. Is it traditional video on demand where you're paying like $3.99 to rent a movie? Is it called TVOD?
Transaction video.
Transaction. Yeah. So it should be PTVOD, actually, premium transaction video. There's another, what's it called? Acronym?
AVOD, yes.
Yes, that's an acronym, right? Where you have the like NATO, yes, North American. So AVOD is ad-supported video on demand. That's where I go to, say, YouTube, and I watch an old episode of, I'm making it up, but say, Welcome Back, Cotter. I don't know if that's on there. But I can watch it, but there are some ads on it. So it's ad-supported video on demand. I get to say, okay, I want to watch this, but I will have to watch some ads. Usually not as many as you would see if you sat down in syndication and watched it on Comedy Central or back in the old days on ABC, CBS, and NBC. But there will be ads, just like the Peacock Network. That's kind of an AVOD service.
Right.
You don't have to subscribe to it, but there will be ads, though presumably you can pay more and see fewer ads or no ads at all. So reruns of TV shows seen as AVOD, AVOD, rather than a syndication, those pay out just pennies on the dollar even when they're increasingly popular. So you got a show on YouTube, they're not going to have as much ads on them. Those ads will not be charging as much. So obviously you're going to get less, but it should be proportional. It's not that it should be, you know, it should be based on what they're actually making. Not say, well, it's AVOD, that doesn't count. We'll give you 10%. You know, it's like, no. You're making more and more money every day. We want our fair cut of that.
Well, you know, Lou Wasserman would say, hey, you know what? Do I pay the plumber every time I flush the toilet?
You should. And there's big money. We're talking about streaming because there's so much money in it. Global streaming subscription revenue has almost doubled in the last 4 years up to 2019. It's at $37 billion worldwide. In another 4 years, come 2023, it's expected to hit $62 billion worldwide.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. And people want their cut, don't they? So the WGA has a lot on their plate. This is just one more big example of what they're fighting for.
Well, now, speaking of things on our plate, I have no transition into our obituary section.
There's no need. That wraps up Inside Baseball. It's time for the obituaries.
Hey, that's a good transition. I like that. Let's use that one. We're going to go with that one right there.
Well, who died this week? It just happened a few hours ago.
Well, CBS News legend Bill Small, he died at the age of 93.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've never heard of him. I'd never heard of Bill Small. He is a legend. He worked for a string of major outlets. He was president of NBC News, president of UPI, chairman of the News and Doc Emmy Awards. But his greatest contribution was as Washington bureau chief at CBS News. He had a murderer's row of reporters there from 1962 to 1974, covering Watergate and Vietnam and all the stuff happening in those years. From within CBS, he hired Marvin Kalb, Dan Rather, Harry Reasoner, Dan Shore, Eric Severi. If you're a news junkie at all, those names should resonate. And new hires at the time, he brought in Bob Schiffer, Ed Bradley, Bernard Shaw, Bernard Kalb, and Bill Moyers, one of my favorite journalists of all time. CBS also noted he was a big champion of hiring women, including Leslie Stahl, Diane Sawyer, Connie Chung, on and on and on. So he is a big figure in news in general, a big figure at CBS News in particular. And it just points out how there are so many great people who do great jobs that, you know, we're not always aware of. If there's someone in your country, your territory that has died or you want to bring attention to or a story that we're not tracking and we're not talking about, let us know, because we're not so on top of what's happening in Poland and Australia, New Zealand and Germany and Spain. So we need your help. So reach out to us.
Yeah, I mean, we might not cover it the week that it happens, but if you let us know about it, we'll cover it the following week.
Or just knowing about it lets us be more informed down the road. It will be useful and we'll really appreciate it if we can, even if we can't always cover it or give you a shout out.
Well, and, you know, speaking of shout outs, we should shout out to Charles Lippincott, who died at the age of 80. He was a PR genius. He died from complications of a heart attack. But, you know, really, I think his work on Star Wars was probably what cemented his reputation.
Well, no doubt about it. He worked on campaigns for a lot of key films in the 70s and 80s. Westworld, Alien, Flash Gordon, Flash, Savior of the Universe. But it was his work on Star Wars that made him a legend. He really rewrote the book on grassroots marketing and innovative campaigns. Comic-Con. He began the transformation of Comic-Con from a geek fest to a prime launching pad for blockbusters by bringing Star Wars to San Diego in 1976. No one had thought of this, really. I assume some other movies and TV shows came before that. But nobody had brought all the big stars. Nobody created the hoopla that he did. Nobody really thought of Comic-Con as a way to really promote a movie. But that was just the start of his innovations for Star Wars. He got Marvel Comics to launch a series about Star Wars before the movie came out to prime the pump. He did cross promotions with the Donnie Marie Show and the Richard Pryor Show. He convinced the studio to trademark each and every character. They should kiss his feet for the rest of his life, I hope, for doing that. He even arranged for the Star Wars Christmas special in 1978, which was designed to keep the movie uppermost in people's minds while a sequel was worked on and the movie was still in, you know, coming into theaters. You know, nobody's perfect. So I actually saw the Star Wars Christmas special, and even Charles Lippincott, he ain't perfect. But, you know, you work on Star Wars, you're going to be mentioned in your obituary. That is the first thing people will mention. It's true for boom operator Ken Nightingale. He died at the age of 92, and if you're a really hardcore geek, you know him as the boom guy in pink shorts. When you look at old stills or old footage of Star Wars being made, you'll see this guy in the desert, no shirt, just shoes, and hot pink, like disco shorts. This guy's there holding a mic, and as somebody said, I'm sorry, I don't remember who, he said, "I just want you to realize every line of dialogue you hear in Star Wars was recorded by a guy in hot pink shorts."
and the funny thing is, like, I think on every movie since then, they've done like pictures of boom operators holding, you know, wearing pink shorts.
Oh, really?
It's become a thing. Yeah,
I wear hot pink shorts to do the podcast.
Oh, well, you know, it's a good thing we're audio only. That's all.
You got me on video, so you have no choice. There they are. Woohoo! All right. Anyway, don't worry. I'm not really. But that does wrap up our show, doesn't it?
That's true. And you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. You know, hopefully someday Spotify as well. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us, ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or on Facebook. Like us, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, they can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group, MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilds has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's hotpinkshorts.com. And yes, it's available.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to michaelgilts.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.